Appreciate the study thus far. I should say that when we talk about the book of Zechariah, I thank you, brother, for the opportunity to speak on it, I think. The book of Zechariah, I want to start off by just highlighting just a couple of things about it. When I started studying it, I looked at some of the, quote, experts that had written on it. I looked at Haley. I looked at a brother named Gil that had done some writing on it and others. And the one thing they consistently said about Zechariah is it is the revelation of the Old Testament. And so that immediately kind of gives you some perspective about some of the difficulty and the challenges that exist when you talk about the book of Zechariah. Let me start off by talking about Zechariah just briefly as a individual or as a person, because I believe that that background is clearly given in the scriptures. Zechariah began his prophetic work basically at the same time and under the same conditions as Haggai did, as we've heard mentioned. Haggai dealt with some very specific things, such as the rebuilding of the temple. Zechariah also dealt with that as a key and important topic. Zechariah's writing was in the 8th month of the 2nd year of Darius, even as Haggai's was the 6th month of that 2nd year. When we look at the Bible, we see that some 39 times the name Zechariah is mentioned, and it's associated with, some authorities say 27 different men, others say in the low 30s. But this we know, the prophet Zechariah was identifiable by specifically what was written in Zechariah chapter 1 and verse 1. He was Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo the prophet, and therefore he was identified as one that was a priest. He was, according to Ezra chapter 5, verse 1, chapter 6, and verse 14, he was not only the grandson of a prophet, but he himself carried out the priesthood and also had a father which had, they thought, passed away at an early age, and therefore, as you read on, you will see the reference to him and to his grandfather. Basically, he was the head of his grandfather's house as being a priest, and therefore, when you look a little further, you'll see in Nehemiah chapter 12, verse 10, and chapter 12, verse 12, the reference to the fact that it was in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Joshua, at the time when he was high priest. Let's move on very quickly and just talk a little bit about the name Zechariah. The name Zechariah just simply means Jah remembers, or the Lord remembers. Now, I read a number of authorities that said there's no significance to that, because that name had, shall we say, that import of God remembering, but it also had the import of the fact that it was used so frequently that Zechariah meant God remembers for a lot of people in the Bible. I'm not sure I agree with that. I think that pretty clearly the Lord remembering someone is always significant. And when you have that as an indication in the name, it quite honestly sets it apart in my mind. In looking, the New Testament version, or the New Testament mention of Zechariah, is Matthew 23 and verse 35. And in this particular setting, I believe that's not Zechariah the prophet, but the Zechariah that's referred to in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, verse 20 through 22, that actually suffered those fates that Jesus Christ would talk about in the book of Matthew. If we look a little more at this, I think that one of the key things that we see is Zechariah's message of the rebuilding of the temple is covered in some of the initial chapters. The book of Zechariah has contains the eight prophecies, or eight visions that were seen, and then also four prophecies that conclude in chapters 9 through 14. And really, the challenge about the book of Zechariah is that it is filled with some apocalyptic language and apocalyptic literature. Let me try to begin to look at some of those passages and some of the things that the book of Zechariah does. I think that it's very important that we understand with Zechariah that there are some key things. And I'm going to try to if you will, summarize just some of the key things that the book of Zechariah brings out. I think the book of Zechariah teaches the child of faith to understand that the fullness of God's time is based on God's time, not our time. And that's a very hard lesson sometimes for us to understand, because we have a tendency to look at the time frames we think things should happen in. Whenever we look, we see that it's been proven through the scriptures, even though there be trials, even though there be tribulations, even though there be difficulty and suffering, it is for a season or for a limited time. And God is in control of that. God's promises are confirmed, and Zechariah shows those time and time again. In Zechariah's visions and his prophecies, he refers to components of not only building the temple, but building faith, building strength as God's people. And I think that the key that we can learn today is God loves builders, and God rewards builders with blessings. And we'll talk about that a little more as we go into this study a little deeper. One of the key verses in Zechariah is Zechariah chapter 1 and verse 3, and he simply says, "Return unto me, and I will return unto you." How much of a theme that could be for 1999 as well as it was for the people of Zechariah in Zechariah's day. I think that it's important to see that there's an element of captivity in apocalyptic books that are written. Daniel, for instance, Revelation, and Zechariah all have that apocalyptic element that shows or that results shows the result of them being in captivity. In chapters 9 through chapters 10, we see, in a broad sense, the outline of the triumphs that would be won by Zion. And that shows, again, there's some apocalyptic or looking forward. In chapter 11, verses 1 through 17, he talks about the good and foolish shepherds, and we'll deal with those in a little more detail later. But then in chapters 12 through 14, he deals completely with the final events. And again, that shows some of the apocalyptic literature and the impact of Zechariah providing that. Let me move into the kind of beginning parts of Zechariah. In Zechariah, the first division of scriptures is Zechariah chapter 1, verses 1 through 6. And we have here the situation of not only the Zechariah himself and the description of Zechariah, but we have very clearly stated the situation that had to be dealt with. And that situation was one of Israel, or of the fathers. In Zechariah chapter 1, I'll read verse 3. "Therefore saith thou unto them, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Turn ye unto me, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will turn unto you, saith the Lord of hosts." Now, I neglected to mention that one of Zechariah's favorite statements was, "Thus saith the Lord." Some 35 times in Zechariah, he uses that expression. And when we study our Bibles, one thing we have to be cognizant of is when the Lord is speaking 35 times, there's a lot of listening we need to do. There's a lot of listening and a lot of learning that needs to happen. In looking at this particular chapter, we understand that he starts off, God does, with some of the frailties of humanity. The people are reminded by the prophet of God's displeasure. And in those first 15 verses, he uses that God was sorely displeased 3 specific times, as I remember it. In verses 1 through 6, he reminds them of their responsibility to repent and to walk in God's ways rather than the evil ways. When we look, we see that he's given them instructions to simply turn because of God's displeasure. And the Hebrew word displeasure there simply means to crack off, to burst out in rage. And so those people had been in captivity, as has been pointed out by other brothers. They had been in captivity because of the fact that they had brought God's rage upon them. And so Zechariah again starts off with that lesson. What was the lesson there? They refused to hearken, according to the first chapter there in verses 1 through verses 6. In verses 1, or excuse me, in chapter 1 and verse 2, he simply told them that they not only were displeasing in their evil ways, but they refused to hear what God had to say. And I think that's a very significant point that we need to keep in mind, is not refusing the will of God, not refusing to listen to God, as one of the more significant things that we can do. Let me try to give a little more of a summary here before I start into the prophecies and talk about what I think the book of Zechariah actually brings to us. When you look at the book of Zechariah, you see a people and you see these pictures, and I think it can be summarized into five pictures. You can see a picture of captivity experienced by God's people. You can see a picture of sin practiced by God's people. You can see a period in which God's people are supposed to be working in rebuilding the temple. And then it gets prophetic. You see the picture of the Messiah. You can look on and you can see after the picture of the Messiah, the picture of the end, salvation, the end of all things. I think the important lesson, the important message we see in starting out Zechariah is the fact that God has always and always will bless his people when they are obedient. And he will always and has always rewarded his people when they are disobedient. Let me move on very quickly. Whenever we look, we see that in talking about the man and the situation here, it's been brought out in Haggai that the temple had lied in waste. And we definitely would just mention Ezra 4:24, where the Bible simply says the ceasing of the work on God's building occurred. We can look on and we can see the fact that in Ezra chapter 5 and verse 1, that the prophets warned those of Judah and Jerusalem. They prophesied for them to get back to God, to give God the preeminence. And then in chapter 1, verses 2 through 6, the Lord's view of his people caused him to cry out for repentance. In moving on, we want to look very quickly here next at some of the prophecies that are begun in the book of Zechariah. And we want to start by looking at chapter 1, verse 7, and actually these visions, if you will, these night visions actually run through chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. And the eight visions actually point out the need to finish God's temple as the primary thing. But I think there had to be some conditions in place for that to be accomplished, and we will see that he deals with that. The foundation was built. It had sat idle for some 16 years. Now, I want you to get the picture of what's really going on with God's house. As was brought out with Haggai, the people there didn't think there was anything wrong with God's house. Why, they were very comfortable. Their houses were wonderful. And all of a sudden, they're told that God's house is still lying in waste. I want you to really get the picture here. You have a people, I want you to get this, who have been in captivity. And they got out of captivity and out of suffering and out of difficulties. And did they turn to the Lord? Did they run to the Lord, that remnant that came out of captivity? No, they didn't. You know what they started thinking about? All the things they didn't get to do while they were in captivity. All the things they didn't fully enjoy while they were in captivity. And that's what we see these visions start to deal with. In captivity, it seems that there's a very clear point. You can't build safely when you're in captivity. And thus the first vision begins to deal with things of that nature. In the first vision, the Bible simply conveys the fact that there was a rider among the myrtle trees and horses. Now, I think it's very significant here that the prophet saw that red horse, behind him other horses. And you know, the prophet inquired. Zechariah said, "What does this mean?" And as Zechariah asked that question, it became very obvious as the word was explained more to him what was going on. Now, there's a number of important points that we could make about this first prophecy, but what we will say is that when those horse people were riding, those horsemen were riding, the prophet began to talk about the fact that they were those that were sent by Jehovah to go to and fro through the earth. Now, that may sound familiar, and it probably does, because you remember a guy named Satan. And in Job chapter 1 and verse 7, Satan, when God asked him where he had been, he said, "I've been going to and fro through the earth." Here's the beautiful picture. A people of captivity, a people who had suffered, could see that not only was Satan and Satan's power going to and fro through the earth, but God had His divine hand of protection going to and fro to the earth, through the earth also, providing for them that protection that they needed. When we look on, we see that not only does he mention that, but he conveys the fact that the purpose was to, God's protection was given so that they could rebuild the temple. You know, I don't know about you, but I don't work too well if I think somebody's trying to harm me and I'm trying to build something. And so it was with God's people. He starts off with a prophecy here that shows that God was providing protection. They had been returned to Jerusalem by the mercies of God. They had been returned and been able, the small remnant of those people, to come from a land of captivity into a land of promised prosperity and comfort. And because of that, they had, for some reason, chosen to disobey God. Now, I think there's a very important point, not only for the people of Israel here, but for us also. And that point is simply this: God is always watching over mankind. God is always watching. Sometimes in our lives we get too busy to remember that, and we don't notice that God is watching. In verses 12 through 17, the question and the concern and the answer to some of these questions in the next prophecy is provided. And the response is basically that God has provided these horsemen as protection for his people. He remembers, he's informed, and he does respond to the need of his people. Let me move on very quickly. In verses 18 through verse 21, we see the next prophecy. And that's the prophecy of the four horns and the four craftsmen. And here we simply see those horns, even as in some of the prophetic language, we see the warning associated with it. We see the war indicated, the battle, the destruction, and by which Judah had been surrounded. And therefore, also we see the four craftsmen mentioned. And that simply brings about those that were to destroy the enemies that had attacked, the smiths, as that Hebrew word simply conveys. They were to build that protection authorized by God. And there has simply been the statement of the fact that they are an important part of the power of God. God helps protect us when we're building for Him. In looking on, we see that God not only does and will protect His people, but He'll protect those that are working towards accomplishing the goal which He has set forth. In verses 18 through 21, the Bible simply shows that the nations that were round about them had been instruments of destruction to Israel. They had been instruments of damage and had been totally the ones that had held them in captivity and penalized them. And so when we look, we see that God shows the next thing as the vision was that those nations that were the instruments of destruction were suddenly going to have havoc rained on them. Or in other words, they were going to be put in that same position that they had put the people of Israel in. They were going to be utterly fought and destroyed. As a matter of fact, the key point here is that God's safety is safe indeed. When God provides safety to us, it's safety if we'll stay in it. And that's the point that Israel was provided here. In the next vision, in chapter 2, verses 1 through 13, you read of a man with a measuring tape that went out to measure Jerusalem. And it simply talks about the outer boundaries of Jerusalem were being measured and were being sized up. But as he ran out, the angel ran after the young prophet. And the angel said that Jerusalem shall be inhabited, according to chapter 2, verse 4. Jerusalem shall be inhabited as villages without walls, by reason of multitude of men and cattle therein. God has promised that He would be the glory in the midst of them. He's promised that safety. The key is here that what we see is the prophecy of the fact that Jerusalem would be at peace. They wouldn't need the wall surrounding it to protect it. So that shows further God's goodness and His protection. We see further the theme of the divine protection versus the way we as human beings think. Now, if we've just been captive, and we've been held captive as a people, and God tells us to go and back to the land that we were captured in and start building, the first thing we'd say is, who's going to keep our enemies from attacking us? They live all around us, the Medes to the north, the Persians to the north. They're all around us. Who's going to protect us? Well, the answer here was God. And so Jerusalem was like cities without walls. You know, there has some prophetic nature to that. I believe the church is a kingdom without walls. When you think of it from a spiritual standpoint, and that also is something that we see the Messiah, a little bit of messianic application here as we look on. The Bible simply says, sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion, for lo, I come, and I will dwell in the midst of thee, saith Jehovah. And we see here that that singing and that rejoicing indicates safety. Let me move on to the next vision that's provided. When we look in the next vision, we see in that fourth vision represented in chapter 3, verses 1 through 10, Joshua was clothed, he was examined, and he was admonished. Now, the significance here is that Jerusalem, that is of the future, will be better than the Jerusalem of the past. They had the temple built. The temple was significant. It was destroyed. They were commanded to rebuild the temple. But what they had to look forward to was a better covenant or a better agreement. Jerusalem was going to be better. And therefore, the temple of old, it was remembered, but it was remembered as something that was not to be focused on, because the temple that they were about to build was going to have that better element. They were taught in this situation hope. They were taught hope and focus on the things that God has presented to be done now. As a matter of fact, in that vision, Joshua here, the high priest, was before the angel of the Lord. And guess what? Satan was on his right hand. Another important principle for the child of God: when the Lord is around, Satan is there too. In Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 15, the Bible simply said it like this: I set before thee good and evil. Choose good. It's that simple when looking at the circumstances that face us day by day. We see God commanded them to not only kingship. And so we see that that was God's desire, even as it's His desire today, that we remove the filth of sin, that we clean ourselves up and get dressed in the royal garb provided. In verse 7 of that third chapter, we have no reason to believe that God has ever set anyone in a position of service or promised them redemption where God would not reject them if they became unfaithful. And so we need to understand that this promises to the people of Israel or the children of Israel were indicating them being faithful. Now, we presume the vision with chapter 3, verses 11 through chapter 5. And there's basically two elements that are dealt with here. And those two elements simply by principle are acquittal and forgiveness. And when we look at Judah from the mind or the eye of sin and captivity to royalty, we can see an ultimate picture of that forgiveness and that acquittal. In chapter 4, we see the next prophecy of the lamp with the golden lampstands. And specifically, he asks about those lampstands and then talks about the olive tree. In chapter 4, verses 1 through 14, simply those golden lampstands or candlesticks take on a meaning of giving light. They provide light, the glory of light being God Himself. And so God's Spirit for Israel, even as for today, is the glory fuel by which the lights are burning. In chapter 4 and verse 6, we have reference there to Zerubbabel, which was mentioned in Haggai's teaching. And the fact of the matter is, it says that Zerubbabel was talked to by the angel, and he was a key figure in the vision of the two anointed ones. And when we looked at this, what we saw most often noted about that was that Zerubbabel being the governor and Joshua being the high priest, there was a meshing, if you will, or a wedding of the priesthood and the kingship together, which shows basically a type of Christ, or more of a messianic element to that. And so we see that those things were combined. In chapter 5, we have the prophecy, or the vision of the flying scroll or flying roll, and he gives the dimensions, but quite simply, the answer to this one is very short and very sweet. He says that it contained upon it curses against the ungodly. And so the point, quite simply, is that the God of the temple will surely punish all who fall, who fail, who decide that obeying him is not worthy, are not their objective, and those that engage in wickedness. When we look on, we can see the latter part of this next prophecy in chapter 5, verses 5 through 11, which some say is a continuation of the prior flying scroll vision. And this seventh vision simply is considered by some to be basically a vision of where the woman, which was representing wickedness, was put into an ephah. Well, an ephah was just a measuring container or a basket. And the lead that was referred to as being thrown, the talent of lead, was actually viewed as that lid to the basket. And therefore, they were taking her away to the land of Shinar. Now, the land of Shinar has significance in that it is the place of wilderness. It was the place of wickedness. It was where, for instance, the Tower of Babel was being built in Babylon, and it was the place where they had just been held captive some short time before. And so that wickedness was to be removed from God's temple. It was to be removed from God's people, and thus the result of purity was to be brought forth. When we go to chapter 6, verses 1 through 8, we have another prophecy of four chariots and horses between the mountains that are observed. And there's two mountains, and obviously this, again, as it did in the first one in chapter 3, brings forth the thought of war. It brings forth the vision of the picture of those chariots coming from brass or copper mountains, as it were. And they're drawn by red, black, white, and grizzled or mixed color horses that were very strong, or in other words, as the Hebrew indicates, they were very swift in their movement. And it signifies not only the winds of the heavens, which gives them more of the swiftness, but again, their purpose was to go to and fro through the earth. And so God's protection was extended. And the voice that was commanded, that Joshua the high priest was giving out, was a message that simply said that the promise was to Joshua that the temple would be built. Now, you know, God didn't beat around the bush there and say, well, sometime you're going to get to it again, or you got 16 more years. He said, the temple will be built. And it was very straightforward, and it was very direct promise in that particular statement. When we look in chapter 6 and verse 13, the prophet urges the completion of the temple as a necessary step. And I want you to get this. It was a necessary step to, if you will, bring them to Christ. To get them to focus on the fact that worship was a part of being pleasing to God. And so the holy temple was regarded as holy, and God was ready to protect it from evil and from wicked and from those things of sin. Let me move on very quickly. In chapter 7 through chapter 14, the book of Zechariah contains four prophecies. And those four prophecies really emphasize just a few things that bring out more of the messianic nature. And because I see I'm running out of time here, okay, I've got just a few minutes. I'll cover just a few of these, and then I'll talk in conclusion about some of the messianic nature and messianic prophecies that we can look up later for our convenience. In chapter 7, verses 1 through chapter 8, verse 23, some of the Jews came into the region of Babylon, and they came there to inquire of the priest of the temple concerning the fast that they used to observe. When they were in captivity, they observed fasts that were in memory of, I think it was Gilead, who was the governor, and also in memory of the fact of the day when the temple was destroyed. Now, historians say that's December 4th of 518 B.C., if I remember correctly on that. And so they observed that specific day. Now think about that.
Here's the people of God. Here's their place of worship. Not only is their governor assassinated and killed, but the temple that they hold so dear is destroyed. So they started observing fast unto the Lord. And so they came to the Lord once they had built the new temple, and they said here, and they made the inquiry and said simply, do we need to continue keeping these fasts? And basically God's answer to them was as follows. When ye fasted, did ye fast unto me, even unto me? I want you to get this. Let me say it the way we would say it today. God said they never even asked him about starting a fast. He never even told them to go start a fast. They took that upon themselves to design those fasts and memories for those things. So why would he have them continue it? Now you may think about that reasoning, and it gets even better because God says, wait a minute. You were in captivity because you didn't listen to me. Why would I have you fast? All you had to do is look and listen to, and he goes full circle, comes right back to chapter 1. Listen to the prophets. Even as your fathers refused to hearken unto them. And so the prophecy here really brings out the fact of the disobedience of Israel and how God had no respect for the fast simply because they were man-made. They were of human origin. And they were those types of fasts that were not, and I emphasize, were not a part of the spiritual plan of God. Let me just mention chapters 9 through chapters 14 and talk for a moment about the messianic prophecies. I didn't mention it by way of introduction, but Zechariah is thought second only to Isaiah in the amount of messianic prophecies that are provided. I'd like to just mention a few of them, and you can write them down and look at them at your leisure. But in an overview of the book of Zechariah, I would be remiss if I didn't talk and mention at least the broadness of those prophecies. In Zechariah chapter 9 and verse 9, we have a prophecy there from Zechariah that I believe is messianic in nature. And he simply says there in chapter 9 and verse 9, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, and upon a colt, the foal of an ass. Now that specific prophecy, you can find what I believe are some of the fulfillments of it in Matthew chapter 21, verse 4, and in John chapter 12, verse 15. We also have a messianic prophecy in Zechariah chapter 11 and verse 12. In Zechariah 11 and verse 12, he simply said, and I said unto them, if ye think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. You'll find that in Matthew chapter 26, verse 15. Matthew 27, beginning with verse 9 and going on through that chapter, you'll see that same thing mentioned. In Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 10, in the latter part of that verse, he talks about, and they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for me, for him, as one mourneth for his only son. And then if you look in John chapter 19, verse 37, and Revelation verse 1, or chapter 1, verse 7, you'll see that prophecy. In Zechariah chapter 13 and verse 7, he simply gives another messianic prophecy. And that simply says, verse 6, and one shall say unto him, what are these wounds in thine hands? Then he shall answer, those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends. You'll see references in Matthew chapter 26 and verse 31, Mark 14, verse 27. And then in Zechariah 9 and verse 10 and Zechariah 13 and verse 1, you'll see references to the fact that the Messiah was to be a Messiah from sea to sea. And you'll see that also set forth as a principle in the New Testament. In closing, last, the honesty of God's people is talked about by Zechariah. In Zechariah chapter 8 and verse 16, you'll see honesty of God's people is emphasized. And in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 25, you'll see in the New Testament, the honesty of God's people is emphasized. We could mention more, but our time is up.